This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station. Night School on BFM 89.9.
Hi, I'm Sharad Kutan, and welcome to the show that walks you through some fundamental concepts in the social sciences and humanities. Together with Amat Fuad Ramat, the show tries to reveal how various thinkers have grappled with theories and concepts they have constructed to best understand how the world works. Each week, Fuad or I will lead a discussion on a concept or a classic text which can shed light on the world around you. Fuad, the heavy burden of leading the lecture falls on your shoulders yet again.
Well, it is quite a heavy burden, I think, because this week we will be talking about evil. And our discussion will center on three questions. How much do we really know about evil? Can we understand it? Or is it something beyond all human comprehension? To guide us through those questions, we shall be considering this phrase or even concept called the banality of evil, made popular by Hannah Arendt in her excellent work, Eichmann in Jerusalem, A Report on the Banality of Evil. We shall talk about what that concept means, why it continues to divide opinions, and what, if anything, can we still learn from it.
Who is Hannah Arendt?
She was basically a political philosopher who gained fame throughout the 20th century. And she had a very interesting life. She was born of German-Jewish heritage. But because of the Second World War and the Holocaust, she had to flee to America. And she had lived in a lot of ways in exile, not just politically because of the Nazi regime, but also socially, culturally, and even intellectually, because while the two main streams of thought at that time were capitalism, communism, her whole project was in trying to find a radical third way, not a compromise, but something other. Something that would replace or challenge capitalism and communism towards a higher notion of freedom.
And in the title, Eichmann in Jerusalem, I mean, who is Eichmann?
The Eichmann in that title refers to Adolf Eichmann, who was a lieutenant colonel in the Nazi SS. And he was the subject of a very famous trial in Jerusalem, conducted by the Israeli government, after which he was hung because he was found guilty.
Off the bat, I just wonder if a discussion about evil presupposes that somebody has a religious outlook, that, you know, someone like me, I'm an atheist, I don't believe in God, I don't believe in a devil. Does the question of evil even arise within my frame of belief?
That's a very good question. In fact, it's kind of a deep question to start off our discussion with. But I think there are two points that you highlight there. One is the religious origin of what we would typically think of as evil, right? So the devil, for example, is probably the proto-supervillain, if there ever was one, right? Where, you know, the way we think of the devil is a reflection of how averse we are to even the thought of evil, right? This is, we always think of evil as extra-human or supernatural. And this had largely to do with because religion is a project of self-perfection. And in that journey towards achieving self-perfection, which religion furnishes, we project a kind of image of evil. And in that projection, assume that evil is this other kind of phenomenon that is sort of beyond human comprehension. Now, do people who are not of religious persuasion have something like that? Yes. And you can find this. And in fact, this is why Arendt's essay was so controversial, because she saw that same type of projection of evil in how the Holocaust was being discussed as this real abomination of human nature, the most horrific tragedy ever known to mankind. And so there's all these kinds of ostentatious claims about what the Holocaust signified, which she felt was problematic because it was not a sufficient account of evil. In fact, it distorted evil as she believes we should understand it.
Again, as an atheist, when I think of evil, I think of the devil. I think of an embodiment of evil. And mm-hmm. Evil takes on a persona, mm-hmm. right? But here, I'm assuming we're actually going beyond the question of that kind of supernatural entity. We're thinking about evil as some sort of ethical state.
Ethical state an ethical or unethical choices committed by humans. That was her particular concern in how we tend to project extra human or supernatural, not supernatural, I wouldn't say supernatural, but this bombastic and outrageous notions of evil behavior on people, right? So when we think of serial killers, when we think of dictatorships, we think of these phenomena as being led by some evil mind, and that this evil mind is always scheming, is some sort of a twisted genius, that they're willing to do things that normal people wouldn't do. So there's this idea that evil has to be something really, really outrageous and
extraordinary.
Extraordinary and incredulous, where she's trying to write against that. And she, in fact, in many ways, what she will conclude is that, you know, evil is rather superficial, right? That there's nothing really profound or deep about evil acts or monstrous crimes. That contrary to what we usually assume about evil things or evil people, Hannah Arendt says that evil is in actuality an ordinary and pretty straightforward phenomenon. There's nothing deep about it, nothing really profound about evil acts or evil choices per se. In a way, one can say that what Arendt is basically showing is that evil is rather boring. There's nothing really mystifying about it.
And so the word banality, right, mm-hmm, or the banal, mm-hmm, which is a word that suggests something is ordinary, pedestrian, mm-hmm, mm-hmm, unexceptional, you know, even rather commonplace.
Correct. And for that reason, it's something very understandable.
Is Arendt, as a philosopher, deploying the notion of evil that can connect with our ordinary lives? I mean, say somebody does something to me, you know, they rob my house, or they cheat me at the store, or a taxi driver's meter is showing 2 ringgit more than it ought to. I mean, is that an instance of evil? Is evil equivalent to crime? Is it equivalent to cheating? You know, all those kind of offenses we might encounter in daily life.
Yes and no. That's a great question, Sharad. But before we get into that, which is a more advanced part of understanding this concept, let's get back to more fundamental aspects of it and sort of talk about what exactly people find controversial or unusual about this this concept that evil is boring, that evil is very ordinary. And in fact, that has been the most frequent response to Arendt's argument. Right? People say that by rendering evil mundane, Arendt is being indifferent to suffering. Right? It runs against our instinctive reaction that when we think of evil things. Or as a result, she's been accused of trivializing the plight and pain of real-life victims of oppression and violence. The criticisms against her were considerable and got rather hostile too. And the hostilities, I said before, had largely to do with because of the case study that she based her conclusion on. As I said before, Adolf Eichmann is a top Nazi official who was in charge of organizing the mass deportation of Jews from all across Europe to Nazi concentration camps. And Eichmann's hearing was very dramatic. It gripped global attention. Getting Eichmann to Israel to stand trial itself was already a scandal, as he was kidnapped by Mossad agents in Argentina, where he sought exile after Nazi Germany fell. And this was in 1961, not long after the Second World War, when wounds of the Holocaust were still fresh. So it was no wonder that many were offended to hear Arendt conclude that evil is banal, especially after seeing and hearing for herself in the flesh the testimonies of Eichmann himself, a key engineer of the final solution. Right, so that phrase, the banality of evil, even led to accusations that Arendt lacked the love of the Jewish people. So it was very acrimonious, and people balked at the thought that this top official in the Nazi regime could somehow be like an ordinary man, that he was not this monster that people expected him to be. In fact, there's still a long debate on whether or not he was a monster, because Arendt is still being accused of sort of polishing her observation to suit her thesis rather than actually reporting the trial as it should have been reported.
One of the ways in which the media, in fact, makes a spectacle of unethical behavior or on a mm-hmm. large scale, if you like, is by using words like monster. Mm-hmm. And so we have the Pol Pot, correct, the Stalin, all these, the gallery of rogues that get dragged mm-hmm. out by the popular press in order to explain evil. Mm-hmm. And of course, it leaves the question, and maybe it's something you're going to come to later, you know, the responsibility of all of us, the complicity of the larger population
Correct.
In the creation of these structures that produced, you know, horrific practices like concentration camps or, you know, or ideas like, you know, year zero that the Khmer Rouge and Pol Pot are responsible for.
Correct. And in Malaysia's case, I mean, we have abundant examples. I mean, for the longest time, democracy wasn't in the best shape. People complained about it, but people also had no problems putting up with it for decades. So you're right. There is the element of complicity that Arendt will point out.
What was her response to the criticisms?
Well, I think we have to be careful from drawing such hasty conclusions about the banality of evil to not think that Arendt was downplaying the relevance of evil as a moral category. She exists. She believes that it exists, but she had a very nuanced interpretation of it. Now, Arendt, of course, disagreed with her critics. First of all, we should keep in mind that she used the phrase to refer to Eichmann in particular. And in doing so, she did not have in mind a general theory of evil, nor was she saying anything about the evil of the Holocaust. In fact, she was clear in her position that the Holocaust was the greatest catastrophe of the 20th century. She did not admire Eichmann in any way, nor did she seek to absolve him of his crimes. So to be clear, to say that evil is superficial, which Arendt clearly did say in reference to Eichmann, is not the same as saying that evil is meaningless or that it is something to be taken lightly. The second caveat, and this gets back to the questions you've been raising, is that the concept really gained traction and took a life of its own beyond Arendt's theory. And her style and method of analyzing Eichmann, which we'll talk about soon, was something many other social scientists and political thinkers adopted and engaged with to understand other evil phenomena. Thus, from a particular observation, the banality of evil became something of a catchphrase or a useful heuristic device to highlight a different, more mundane side to evil than what we normally find in our reactions.
Okay, so I get the caveats now. So how do we understand then what she was trying to do by theorizing Eichmann's position? What does this banality of evil really help us understand about the world?
Okay, I want to proceed slowly so that we do not mischaracterize her. So let's start with Arendt's analysis and then move on to the larger lessons. Recall that the banality of evil was the conclusion she drew after observing Eichmann's trial. Recall also that this was the trial of a key figure in the Nazi Holocaust. The Holocaust then, as it still is now, tends to be spoken of as the most horrific evil of the 20th century. In fact, it's not uncommon for us to hear it being talked about as the most horrific evil ever known to mankind, often overshadowing other tragedies such as Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the genocide of Native Americans, or the transatlantic slave trade, and definitely not the expulsion of Palestinians from the land. In fact, Elie Wiesel, Nobel Prize winner and Holocaust survivor, referred to the Holocaust as a crime so great it was essentially unspeakable. No word can really describe it. The evil of the Holocaust was so unique, like nothing the world had ever seen before, or so it's claimed. Jewish suffering was not racial, ethnic. It was also, Wiesel claimed, ontological, since it was about shaping another reality, a different world altogether without Jews. Such sentiments were not unusual at the time when Arendt wrote the book, which was in 1961, not long after the World War. Nationalist Jewish sentiments were triumphant at the time, and the pain of the Holocaust in many ways drove the agenda of Eichmann's persecution and consequent execution, for they finally had in their grasp a key engineer and architect of the Holocaust. In other words, they finally had in their custody, in Eichmann, evil personified.
Before we take a break, I want to play a clip from a newsreel of the Eichmann trial.
In Jerusalem, the trial of Adolf Eichmann begins, reviving memories of the Nazi horrors of the Second World War. Entering the bulletproof prisoner's box is the man charged with the annihilation of millions of Jews in Nazi death camps. Searching problems of conscience and of international law will be raised by this trial, one of the most stirring of modern times. Eichmann himself is impassive as the three judges who will decide his fate enter. Now, after 15 years in hiding, And 1 year after his sensational abduction from Argentina, Adolf Eichmann is indicted on 15 counts of crimes against the Jewish people and crimes against humanity.
He accused, together with others, during the period 1939 to 1945, caused the killing of millions of Jews in his capacity as the person responsible for the execution of the Nazi plan for the physical extermination of the Jews, known as the final solution of the Jewish problem.
Eichmann's attorney, Dr. Robert Savatius, opens by denying the legality of the trial and questions the jurisdiction obtained by Eichmann's forcible capture. Dr. Savatius further suggests that Eichmann be tried by a neutral or international tribunal. Israeli Attorney General Gideon Hausner, the chief prosecutor, replies that no one except the State of Israel has sought to bring Eichmann to justice and cites the Nuremberg war crimes trials as precedent for this trial. Throughout, Eichmann remains icy calm, his fate at last in the scales of justice.
You are listening to a newsreel of the Eichmann trial. We've been discussing Hannah Arendt's idea of the banality of evil. I'm Sharad Kutin with Ahmad Fuad Rahmat, and this is Night School on BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, I'm Sharad Kutin, and together with Ahmad Fuad Rahmat, this is Night School. We're discussing Hannah Arendt's notion of the banality of evil.
I am, as you know, of course, a Jew, feminine, generous, as I hope you can see, born and educated in Germany, as no doubt you can hear.
That was a bit of Hannah Arendt. Let's continue with the conversation.
If you just joined us, we were talking about why this concept was so controversial, and many people didn't like it because what Arendt was claiming about evil was very counterintuitive to what we normally think about it, right? So we always think about evil as this extraordinary, outrageous thing, whereas Arendt was trying to say that evil is actually more commonplace and more mundane than we would normally readily accept. So now we're going to talk about how Arendt came to this conclusion at her trial of Adolf Eichmann, a top official in Nazi Germany. Now, Arendt would concur that Eichmann was evil. She definitely did not see him as in any way like the diabolical genius and fervent anti-Semite that he was described by the media and public sentiment at the time. Arendt noted that Eichmann, this guy who was granted executive powers for the mass deportation of Jews to concentration camps all over Europe, was actually a rather dull man. He wasn't particularly bright. He wasn't very articulate. He also had bad memory. He wasn't very refined, cultured, creative, or even intelligent. Neither was he a very nice, warm, or empathic person. For someone who was supposedly the symbol of evil, he was very one-dimensional. Eichmann did, however, consider himself a law-abiding citizen, doing what he believed the system demanded him to. Arendt said Eichmann was quite capable of sending millions of people to their death, but he was not capable of talking about it in the appropriate manner without being given his language rule.
Fuad, what does she mean by language rule?
So Eichmann was really a by-the-book person. And he was a by-the-book person because he wanted to scale the heights of Nazi rank and file. He wanted to do well in the system. And the system, being a totalitarian system, was full of its quirky customs and conventions. And this included certain ways of referencing officials, certain ways of greeting people, so on and so forth. And Eichmann was so conditioned by the system that he could not really function outside of it, outside of the sensitivities and norms of that system. So what Arendt was trying to show was that he was just very simple-minded kind of guy who thrive in a very simplistic, one-dimensional kind of system.
And so language rules are basically the ways in which we have become accustomed to thinking about the world, describing it, and operating in it. So we're given a set of rules to follow.
Correct.
And I think that's probably very commonplace in Malaysia, right? We know people who have a very bureaucratic mindset. They will say, this is illegal. They'll never ask if it's ethical.
Correct.
They'll always say, I'm doing something that's I'm a law-abiding citizen. There are a lot of Malaysians who are law-abiding. Well, you know, yeah. maybe we could have more of them. But to the extent that we do have them, they're still not capable of asking the next set of questions, which have to do with whether the law itself is ethical or moral or just.
Correct. And you're hitting to a very key point that Arendt made about Eichmann. And that's what makes him ordinary, because this is something that, I mean, we experience often enough. In fact, there's a streak of that inside us as well, right? To kind of function programmatically within the established conventions of our time and place, which have been absorbed by law or which are reflections of certain expectations that legal system has on us. Yeah. In fact, this is for Arendt was a very pernicious side of Eichmann, right? It was not necessarily his anti-Semitism. In fact, the extent to which Arendt even really believed that Eichmann was an anti-Semite is still open to debate. Rather, the problem was in Eichmann's careerist mentality, in his ever-ready and willing desire to work with the system to scale its heights. In fact, Eichmann, viewed from Arendt's eyes, is primarily an ambitious civil servant, trying to make the most of the system to excel in it, through either showing loyalty or banking favors little by little to get ahead. In one instance, Arendt even said in passing that Eichmann's behavior was not that different from politicians in post-war Germany. Now, this is not to say that the results of their actions are all the same, but they nonetheless functioned on the same logic, the simple, matter-of-fact, linear, bureaucratic, careerist logic.
And so hence the banality of evil.
Yes. The important thing to note here is that all that Arendt described about Eichmann is quite the opposite of what people expect when they think of evil, or even the Holocaust. The tendency usually is to think of evil as devilish, uncivilized, pathological, conniving, shrewd, overpowering, daring, always scheming to win and get away with evil deeds. In fact, when we think of an evil person, we tend to think of a supervillain or a monster, something beyond human, unthought of, someone that strikes fear and terror in our hearts. So we don't think of the average pachi in the civil service as necessarily diabolical. But with the Nazi Germany context in mind, if I may have some leverage to draw analogies here, this in effect was what Arendt was trying to show, that evil is in actuality rather down to earth, the choices behind them can be understood quite plainly. Therefore, what Arendt is trying to show is that evil is in many ways very familiar to human life and behavior. And we can see why this position of hers was received with so much acrimony, since it still runs contrary to dominant historical memories about the Holocaust and conventional expectations and perceptions about evil.
Now, if evil is banal, are we kind of robbing the notion of evil of its specific character? Because I think we all would agree we do bad things.
Sure.
But we agree that perhaps also there are different grades of bad things. Mm-hmm. A child stealing a bit of candy is different from somebody, you know, siphoning off money from the EPF, for instance.
Sure, sure.
You know, and an evil is just that grade of badness that we want to reserve for things that are that truly
diabolical,
truly monstrous.
Yeah,
and you know, like, okay, and you know, let's think of the rape and mutilation of that young mm-hmm. woman in Delhi. Mm-hmm, you know, you mentioned this earlier to me mm-hmm. as a possible example, and mm-hmm. I think that, okay, so here the men are going beyond any kind of commonplace notion of sexual gratification. Mm-hmm. I mean, to introduce an iron rod into somebody is evil.
Yeah.
So you kind of like, at that point, lost for words, you're trying to find a word or a category of badness that would capture what they did. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It's cruel, yes, but it's more than cruel.
It's cruel, and I think the dispute is not on the extent to which it's cruel. I think Arendt would say that it is cruel. What she wants to pinpoint is the impulse behind our reactions to evil, and how sometimes our failure to comprehend it or reluctance to even begin to rethink our prejudices of it compels in us the most, one would say, unsophisticated responses, but also the responses that may not be the most clearest at the time, right? Responses that may not be just or adequate or even accurate to understand what was going on. So, for example, in the case, the outrage against the rapist in India, sure, what they did was evil. Sure, rape is wrong. Yes, we must install new laws to protect women. But that doesn't mean that we should react with shock and horror and call for their castration or their execution or to vilify them, right? So when we vilify them, we do not have to assume that what they did was so diabolical that it is incomprehensible or that our reaction to it must be as outrageous as what they did to match the level of audacity or to rise to the level of anger it deserves, you know. So I think the key thing is to note reactions and perceptions. That's what Arendt is trying to go for here, you know, that in classifying evil, which we should do, we should try to understand it in its complete dimension and not necessarily let our insecurities take over. I mean, that's one way of looking at it.
For what earlier you used the word counterintuitive, and that's a very important word because the flip side of it is intuitive. The
Correct.
Idea that somehow we respond to things with our common sense, there is an emotional quality to our responses, and that it strikes us in some sort of unthinking way, not
Correct.
In a bad,
Correct.
Not in a negative sense of unthinking, but
no, unthinking is correct, probably the right way. She used that word too, actually. Yeah,
failure
to think. Yeah.
So what does she want from us? I mean, is she expecting us to respond in an extraordinary fashion, to go beyond our intuitions, beyond our sense of natural justice or whatever it is, and be kind of like cold and distant?
No, that is not what she's trying to say at all. In fact, she was very emotionally affected by the Holocaust. She did not. Her goal is not to downplay evil. Her goal was to call us. Well, there are several goals, but one of the goals in relation to your question is to call us to check our natural intuitions about evil, because as the example she shows is that it can come out of rather ordinary people, right? So our immediate reaction is to always assume that the motivations behind his choices are very diabolical, right? But that's not what she's saying. She's saying that even if the results are diabolical, the motivations behind it may not be. The person behind those diabolical actions and outcomes are not necessarily devilish. They might just be like you and me, right? And that makes evil more comprehensible, because we're not projecting this aura of extraordinary human capacities or the extraordinary moral corruption or emotional failure, but a kind of normalcy. And for Arendt, when we really grasp the fact that even our sort of mundane mode of being may have streaks of evil in it, it makes evil A, more identifiable, and B, more easily corrected, so that we can better move on rather than get trapped in the tragedy and trauma of evil that often overwhelms us emotionally.
So, okay, if we accept that evil in some essential sense is banal, what's at stake for us?
Okay, so several implications here. The first is that evil becomes more comprehensible. It can be understood. It's not this foreboding mystery about the human condition. Evil is not really something so foreign, obscure, and foreboding. It is rather something that is there, what we can pretty much stare into. And that's what Arendt wants to make us try and do, just to look at evil in a sober and clear and direct way, rather than mystify it in so much of our protests and outrage. So there are several implications to this conclusion. We shall start with the implication that Arendt drew, and then move on to the general lessons here. Now, what Arendt saw in Eichmann, the banality to his evil, the root out of which his evil stemmed, was in his rather cavalier inability to think. In fact, Arendt even said that Eichmann acted as if he didn't realize what he was doing. Now, this took a peculiar form in Eichmann, which is careerism. And this is something I think we can all relate to. Now, what does careerism mean? The careerist is one who really only thinks for his own self-advancement, in a world where livelihood and reward are things to be competed for. The careerist is pragmatic. Business is business, and everything is a means to an end which can aid in the advancement of one's career. Everything else is secondary. Arendt, in this sense, inverts the modern narrative that sees merit-based competition as a good thing. To her, it is a sure way of suppressing empathy. Here, Arendt indicts not only Nazism, but modern notions of individual success and reward, where work is primarily result-oriented without taking into account ethics and morality. To illustrate this, think of the hypothetical marketing director in a cigarette company. He sells products which are clearly hazardous to health. He does it for a living throughout his career, say, for example, in the span of 30 years. Perhaps it crossed his mind at some point that what he's doing is bad, but this is checked by the fact that everyone else is doing something to get by in life, he's not breaking the law, and that nobody is really complaining anyway. Thus, his personality, which like anyone else's, is shaped by his career, is defined over the course of his work as separate from the ethical impact of what he does. In being absorbed by the process, he just does not care that the promotion of cigarettes does in fact harm people. His career defines him first and foremost, and in accepting that, he relinquishes his ability to think. And you see this in everyday office ethos, right? We hear of someone getting wrongfully dismissed, we grieve, but we don't do anything about it, we just move on. We hear of some unethical malpractice committed by a company whose product we market, we note it, but we just move on. That was really the same logic underlying Eichmann's choices. For him, it was all about excelling within the ranks of Nazism. And with anti-Semitism already so much a part of the way of thinking, he accepted it as just one phase in the upward path of his career. For Arendt, the question was not just how could someone do something so bad for so long. Of course Eichmann was evil. But what she wanted to know was why. What happened to Eichmann's thinking and empathy? What was it about the daily operations of the Nazi project that pacified Eichmann's capacity to feel? And the answer was not in Nazi ideology per se, which Eichmann at any rate didn't show much enthusiasm for. The reason was because of his individualistic careerism. So that was the particular circumstance in which Eichmann operated and made those heinous decisions. It was just separate from his path of self-advancement, right? And this is something that we see every day in our sort of choices to get by in life.
That's a very interesting conclusion to come to. Something I didn't anticipate.
But that's what Arendt wanted to show. That was the banality in it. So one of the key implications we can draw based on Arendt's observation of Eichmann's careerism is that there's also something dangerously arbitrary about extra-human notions of evil, namely in how it can often blind us to the evils of our own doing. Right? I mean, this is my own personal import of Arendt's theory, which I've seen people represent in many discussions about it. But I think it bears some relevance nonetheless. The belief that evil is an unnatural force obscures the real potentially evil implications of our own everyday choices, which when you think of it is truly banal. Think of the condition of domestic workers in this country, who for the longest time have been working without the right to a paid day off. Even then, many are not allowed to leave the homes in which they work. In the process, they are divorced completely from everyday public life, which human beings are entitled to. They come from afar having to trust their bosses and are often left with no real political recourse to file complaints, either because they are made to stay inside against their wishes, or they were simply not briefed about the system and the rights accorded to them. And this happens every day in millions of Malaysian households. This explains the rampant abuses that continue to be reported, many of which remain unaddressed. But grounding this example in our discussion, it's interesting that this continues to occur every day with little rancor or mass outrage. No Malaysian would like to think that this is in any way evil. But when you really pause to reflect, when you think of what is deprived to the millions of migrant domestic workers, it is hard to think that what we are doing is good either, right? This is something pathological for an outsider. And I explain this to many people visiting the country about how dependent we are on migrant foreign workers. And they're just shocked at the conditions they live in, and they're more shocked at the apathy in which it happens. So what is clear is that it is banal, and that common perception's evil lies not so much in the content of what we call evil, but in our reactions to it. So pausing and reflecting on how we react to evil will do a great deal to not just give a clearer picture of what it is we're describing, but also the impulse behind our reactions to evil. So there are many other examples. Think of the fact that most Malaysians do not recycle, or that most Malaysians harbour racist and sexist sentiments, or fall prey to sectarian politics. Because it is so normalized, and indeed mundane and banal, we excuse ourselves from regarding ourselves in any way evil. And this is where the banality of evil is helpful as a concept, in that we start realizing that we need not project some superhuman, supervillain qualities on our actions for it to be evil. Evil exists even in the more cavalier moments of our taken-for-granted everyday existence.
Oh, Fuad, that was extraordinary. I mean, I really must say I've learned something this week, and I will go and read Hannah Arendt more closely, because it does seem that she has something to say about how we conduct ourselves, even when the consequences aren't the mass extermination of human populations.
Yeah, something for us to reflect on every day, our choices, right? What are the consequences and why do we react and don't react in certain ways?
Thank you so much, Fuad. We've been talking about the banality of evil coined by the philosopher Hannah Arendt. Do get in touch with us via Twitter. I have a Twitter account. It's at Sharad Kutin. Fuad, do you have... He's got to work on his Twitter account. There's also, of course, our Facebook page. You can go to BFM Night School. We're looking forward to continuing this conversation online. And just to note, this show will be repeated on Wednesdays at 9 p.m.
And you can download it in podcast form from the BFM website.
That's www.bfm.my. Till next week, I'm Sharad Kutin with Ahmad Fuad Rahmat for Night School on BFM 89.9, The Business Station.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.